Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
There had been abuse in my family, but it was mostly musical in nature.
Any of this lover's lament crap. I want something peppy, something happy, something up-tempo. I want something snappy.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Katz. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, we open up the Rock Doctors Clinic just in time for a Valentine's Day emergency. We're going to provide two listeners with musical couples counseling.
Plus, Greg and I will review the new album, the first in nearly a decade, from Sade.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time for some music news.
Greg, make no mistake, you and I have two of the best jobs in the world. That's absolutely true every night of the year, except when we are enduring the 3.5 hours of torture that is the annual Grammy telecast. The 52nd annual Grammy Awards were broadcast live from the Staples Center in Los Angeles last Sunday. And typical of the big performances on the show was Beyonce doing that version of Alanis Morissette's You Oughta Know.
Yeah, Jim, as you said, 3.5 hours. We only had 9 awards handed out in that 3.5 hours. Most of the show was devoted to these bombastic performances. Even though the Grammys purport to be about handing out awards in 109 categories to some of the 1,003 nominees, it's really about those TV ratings, and they skewed heavily towards the pop spectrum, towards the celebrity spectrum. You had these big performances by people like Lady Gaga jumping into a cauldron of fire and emerging with this charred makeup on, and Pink, you know, doing a Cirque du Soleil acrobatic routine while singing.
Yeah.
And to the point where, like, is she singing a song at the same time? But look at that. She's spinning around in midair and and raining water down on the audience.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, it kind of left you flabbergasted about, well, what are they really selling here? And what they're selling is a TV show that succeeded very well by Grammy standards. 25.9 million people tuned in this year, a huge increase over last year. They barely got 20 million people to watch last year. So they got what they wanted. They got the ratings boost they wanted, but at the same time, I think they sacrificed some of the artistic integrity that they claim to be standing for all these 50 years.
Well, their credibility has been eroding ever since they started 52 years ago, Greg. In any given year, you can take the winners of the big four Grammys, put them in a Times capsule, look back later and say, really?
Yeah.
That was the best album,
yeah.
You know, not the Beatles, not Bob Dylan, not the Rolling Stones. You know, we had that case this year. Album of the Year went to this young teen ingenue, Taylor Swift, for Fearless. Song of the Year went to Beyonce for Single Ladies, Put a Ring on It. Record of the Year goes to Kings of Leon, a rare rock big prize for You Somebody. And the Best New Artist goes to the Zac Brown Band, These Country Bumpkins. Now, you look at, for example, the big winners in the Paz and Jop poll of rock critics across the country, conducted annually by the Village Voice. Their album of the year was Animal Collective's Meriwether Post Pavilion. Phoenix came in number two, Nico Case, followed by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. You know, really credible artists that I think you could put in a time capsule and in 2020 look at it and say, wow, 2009, that was the mark of excellence, were some of those artists.
Right, and Taylor Swift was not a factor in this year's poll, in part because their album came out in 2008. In general, an album that was not critically acclaimed but yet sold mega boatloads of copies. We need to take a good hard look at this Taylor Swift phenomenon, I think, Jim, because she is one of the best-selling artists of the last few years. Her debut album in 2006 made her a star at the age of 16. She took over the country charts at the time. She was kind of perceived as a country performer because she had a few country music signifiers on her records. You know, a little pedal steel guitar, a little bit of fiddle. Coming out of that tradition, not so much of hardcore country, obviously, Loretta Lynn or what have you, but more out of that 90s superstar mold of Faith Hill and Shania Twain, country crossing over with pop. You know, a suburban girl, grew up in Pennsylvania, and singing about what it's like to be a high school girl. It's interesting, the image that she's put out there. When girls give up their American dolls, they look for role models that sort of fulfill that perfect image of what womanhood should be. And I think that Taylor Swift has sort of filled that role. She sings about, you know, here I am trying to be this girl fitting in high school, and a lot of her young listeners see themselves in these songs. Her last record, Fearless, sold 3.2 million copies, had a boatload of singles on it. That was the album that was nominated for Album of the Year. It looked like, the way the evening was proceeding, that Beyonce was going to run the table, that she was going to win Album of the Year. A veteran artist, she'd been around, it seemed like her year. But instead, Taylor Swift, at the age of 20, according to the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, has made the best album of the last year. So before we get into whether or not this really is the Album of the Year, as the Grammys have declared it, let's play a track from Fearless. It's called 15 by Taylor Swift on Sound Opinions.
Take a deep breath and you walk through the doors. It's the morning of your very first day. You say hi to your friends you ain't seen in a while. Try and stay out of everybody's way. It's your freshman year and you're gonna be here for the next 4 years in this town. Hoping none of those seen you and say, you know I haven't seen you around before. 'Cause when you're 15, somebody tells you they love you, you're gonna believe them. And when you're 15, feeling like there's nothing to figure out, but count to 10, take it in, this is life before you know who you're gonna be. 15.
That is 15 by Taylor Swift on Sound Opinions from Album of the Year, according to the Grammys, Fearless. Greg, I gotta say, I agree with Kanye West. He infamously bum-rushed Taylor Swift's acceptance speech at the MTV Video Music Awards to say that Beyonce was robbed. Of the nominees in the category for Album of the Year, yeah, Beyonce was robbed, although I wouldn't have selected either of these records for Album of the Year. Mm. Taylor Swift really bothers me. I mean, you know, I have a teenage daughter who is enamored of her. I don't think that's an accurate portrayal of young womanhood. And as a feminist, it just offends me. If she looked like Ida Maria, you know, yeah, or Bjork, yeah, I don't think she would have this popularity. She's popular because she's a model.
Well, I disagree to an extent, because 15, if you listen to that song, that is a song where every teenage girl, I think, can see some of her reflected in it. It's about a girl who is, you know, entering high school, for the first time, and she's standing at that doorway into the next 4 years of her life, and she's nervous about it, and she's talking about her fears about and also expectations for that experience. So in that respect, she is addressing a very large and now loyal audience that sees some of themselves in her songs.
But in an age of auto-tune, she is remarkable for how flat her singing is. The girl cannot sing at all.
Well, as she proved on the Grammy Awards night, it was kind of embarrassing, that duet with Stevie Nicks. And, you know, people came back from that saying, well, she's pretty shaky and maybe it was just a bad night. Well, no. Every time I've seen her on a nationally televised award show try to sing, it's been pretty flat. It's
been pretty horrible on Saturday Night Live.
Nothing against her, per se. I mean, in time, she may develop into a credible artist. Right now, she is one of those tweener artists that's bridging the gap between your passions as a young teenager getting into music for the first time and more serious and mature artists who are fully developed. She's not there yet. And for the Grammys to say that this is the album of the year, this is representative of the year 2008-2009 as the highest artistic achievement of that year is pretty darn ludicrous. Tell me about pandering to your young fan base. Talk to me about pandering to your audience ratings, but don't tell me that that's the album of the year.
Well, you know, the Jonas Brothers were more creative than the Beatles as well. Greg, talk about big money in the music industry. We broke the news last week that Assistant Attorney General Christine Varney had held a press conference to announce that the Department of Justice was going to approve the merger of the biggest national concert promoter, Live Nation, with the monopolistic ticket broker, Ticketmaster. The fallout is shaking the entire music industry, every corner of it. We reached out to Live Nation numerous times and were ignored. However, Seth Hurwitz is a concert promoter who testified on Capitol Hill in front of the U.S. Senate last February when the hearings began about this merger. He owns the 930 Club in Washington, D.C. It's one of the most historic rock clubs in America today. He has a company, IMP Productions, that promotes concerts throughout Washington and Baltimore. He books the Meriwether Post Pavilion in Maryland, and he's the force behind the Virgin Mobile Festival at Pimlico in Baltimore. We wanted to get the perspective from him of the independent concert promoter going up against this new behemoth, Live Nation Ticketmaster. Seth, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thanks.
Well, so the Justice Department says, indie promoters out there, don't worry. We're going to create this firewall whereby if you, Seth, use Ticketmaster to sell tickets to one of your promoted concerts, the rest of Live Nation that competes with you to book that same artist will not have access to that information. Do you take any confidence from that?
That's a joke. Let me explain how it works, okay?
Sure, please
do. I'm a promoter. But supposing I have a ticketing division and I'm supposed to have this firewall. Probably in the same building. A dramatization of it. It's like this. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, how's their Springsteen show doing? What do they have going on sale this week? Ah, what have they held for next week? Okay.
That's how it's defeated.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
right.
Like, you got to be kidding me. Here's the whole point, okay, is that if it's enough of a concern for them to say that there needs to be a firewall, then why did they allow this in the first place?
Well, the attitude I was getting from the Justice Department when I was talking to them is that they couldn't stop this.
And this is not true.
Okay.
I was told we couldn't stop this, that it's better to let it go through and regulate it. First of all, they're the only ones saying they couldn't have stopped it. And they threatened to stop it unless they had these restrictions put in. If they threatened to stop it, that means they were going to go through with their threat. What changed? Well, you know, I was told it's because we didn't think we could win. If you're saying that's the only issue here, and it's a matter of, you know, legally whether you'd win or not, then why did you just spend 11 months wasting all of our time asking what we think of this?
We now have this super vertically integrated company that is basically has its feet, hands, and entire body up to its neck in every aspect of the record industry, the music industry right now. Most tellingly, the fact that they were not asked to divest themselves of their management company, Frontline Management, which is managing bands like Van Halen, Fleetwood Mac, more than 200 major acts. Could you address the implications of that and the effect
of that? The whole play is about taking control of the industry, and, you know, you can call their bluff on this very easily, because all you have to do is turn to them and say, fine, you guys can merge. You say you have all these synergies planned and all these ways that this is going to help each other. You can merge if you don't promote the bands you manage. You can merge if you don't do entire tours, you know, where everyone has to play for you at every turn. Call their bluff and watch how fast they say, oh, no, well, then forget it.
Right, or they could have. They own 140 venues. They could have been required to divest
those.
They know
what they're up to. They know exactly what they're doing, and who can blame them if they can get away with it?
Right, right.
Well, I mean, listen, if I could run the world, great, you know, until someone stops me.
Well, so they're running the world, Seth. I mean, that's the implications of what you're saying.
They are running the world, and the idea, first of all, that you can trust them to run it in the interest of the public. Well, let's look at what what just came out in the last week. The settlements that the two principals, Michael Rapino and Irving Azoff, got for making the deal happen. Now, they've lost hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, in the last few years, and yet these executives are, you know, another one of these headlines where the executives are taking millions of dollars while their companies are tanking. There's a fellow named Robert Sillerman bought all the different promoters and made them one company.
With SFX in the late 90s.
Yes, and his claim was synergy,
yeah,
economies of scale, etc. And what did he do? He rolled it up, he sold it to Clear Channel, he made his $100 million, and we haven't heard from him since. But at the time, he was claiming to have the music business interests at heart.
Seth, your company, IMP, is one of only a handful of independent regional concert promoters left in the country. There are a few in New York, Chicago, New Orleans. But what about IMP? Are you going to be okay? Are you going to be able to stay in business against Live Nation?
That's what this is about, is to finally close all the doors. And, you know, what about me? I mean, I've survived this far. I'm in a little different boat from those other guys you mentioned. Those other guys used to promote arena acts all the time, which is not really what I do. You know, I continue to have an alternative, ahead-of-the-curve philosophy, which means, you know, I spot bands before other people do, et cetera. I own the 930 Club in D.C., which is a pretty famous, you know, alternative breeding ground. You know, where I'm going to get whacked is when these bands get big. Forget it.
Do you have the House of Blueses and the smaller clubs coming after your business at the 930? Because we're seeing that in Chicago. Certainly you've seen it in Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the next, you know, they're going to try to create this whole system where, you know, it's all or nothing. You play for us or you don't. And, you know, although they've put in language about retaliation, these guys are very smart. And the way that they get around that is instead of, you know, punishment for not doing it, it's more incentive for doing it. But they're offering things that they can only offer because of the monopoly they've created.
The last thing for you, Seth, the upshot of this for the fan. In the decade that Live Nation and Ticketmaster have taken over the concert business, ticket prices have doubled. Coincidence or not, who do you blame that on? You know, they will turn it around and will say, well, it's the artists demanding this. It's the artists who are driving up ticket prices.
Well, here's how it works. Traditionally, you know, a promoter used to present a band with a proposal or an offer, and they would have a suggested ticket price. The way competition used to work when there was competition is that, you know, as I was a promoter, I remember being presented with, you know, I always played REM, but, you know, I'd make my offer and they'd say, you know, the other people have an offer and with a lower ticket, you need to lower your ticket and match theirs. And I had to lower my ticket. And that was good for the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when there are no alternatives and they're presenting a band with this huge money and they're saying, oh, by the way, we have to charge, you know, $100 a ticket. The bands, you know, they take the money and they look at the ticket and they know it's not right and they think, well, that's the promoter's problem.
Mm.
The ones that still have control and can create competition like Bruce Springsteen, you know, are able to say, you know what, we know we're going to sell out anyway and here's what we want to charge. And, you know, Bruce Springsteen, that's how he's able to come in and sell out every time because, you know, the public doesn't feel like they got jacked last time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very smart way of doing business. But not very many people are as smart as Bruce Springsteen and John Landau, and they're more susceptible to, you know, yeah, we just won a Grammy, and yeah, we can get a $250 a ticket. We're hot right now, you know, and the promoter's going, yeah, see, it's fine, take it. Without competition, that will go unchecked.
Yeah.
You know, when Christine Varney, you know, she came out and made this statement that this stuff's not going to happen anymore. And then the turnaround and not fight this out of fear of losing, it's sad, it's disappointing, it's shocking, and it's kind of sickening.
Seth, thanks for your eloquence and commentary on the Live Nation Ticketmaster merger. We appreciate you being on Sound Opinions.
Anytime you guys need me to run my mouth, I'm pretty good at it.
Coming up on Sound Opinions, Greg and I put on our lab coats and become the rock doctors. We'll help a couple in need of musical therapy. And later on, we have a review of the eagerly anticipated new record by Sade. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. It is time, Mr. Cott, for the two of us to put on our lab coats and become Dr. Cott and Dr. DeRogatis. From time to time on Sound Opinions, we like to do a segment called The Rock Doctors. Listeners write to us and they say, I'm stuck, you know, I'm not feeling right, I have this kind of creeping malaise, I don't know what I need to feel 100% again. So we like to play Rock Doctor and give them a prescription for some music to get them excited about the process of listening to music again, because that's what we live for. With this particular pair of patients, they're a couple, and that seemed fitting because it's Valentine's Day is coming up. Right, Dr. Cott?
Yes, Jim. Kelly and Andrew are a young couple from Chicago just starting out together, and they have a major obstacle in their relationship. Everything seems to be going swimmingly except for their ability to agree on some music that they both can love. So we thought we've got to help this couple out. Let's welcome them to the show right now. Andrew, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you so much.
And Kelly, you are there as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. This is the second couple I believe we've done, Dr. DeRogatis. This is a tandem patient group here, and we have a mutual problem here. I feel very daunted whenever we deal with couples because I feel like a relationship is hanging in the balance based on what kind of prescription we're going to give.
I actually feel like Dr. Ruth, but that's that may be an unrelated problem.
You're looking like Dr. Ruth today. It's a very nice dress you have on, by
Thank
the way.
You. Why don't you guys chart for us what brings you into our office?
Well, the problem is Kelly.
Oh.
No, actually the problem is it's probably more me. I have an incredibly vast musical spectrum. Kelly's is a bit smaller, I'd say.
I have my music that I've been listening to since high school and flowing into college, and I just, once I got into grad school, I kind of stopped listening to the radio, so I stopped listening to new music.
Just not to ask you your age, Kelly, but rough time frame?
I'm 25. But a lot of my musical influences are from classic rock.
The 70s.
Gotcha.
70s, okay.
And Andrew, you say that with some disdain, so I take it you're not...
Well, I mean, the decade itself doesn't hinder me.
It's the fact that I don't listen to Bob Dylan from the 70s. I listen to Queen or Journey from the 70s.
So you're a radio girl. I mean, you listen to music that was on the radio that was popular at the time, and there were certain songs and bands that you liked from those eras.
Right.
Yeah. She likes bar music, stuff that you'll hear in a bar over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bon Jovi and Journey is a great example, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they always play that one Journey song, and everybody starts singing and pumping their fists in the air like it's the first time they've ever heard that song before.
Yes.
Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going anywhere.
Now, Andrew, I'm getting a fair amount of disdain here. Now,
this is what I have to deal with.
Yeah.
Is there a little bit of a music snob thing going here on
yes.
your part?
It's not snobbery so much as it is I'm very passionate about my music, and I'm constantly searching for new bands, and I get very emphatic about the type of music that I like to see. I'm also a heavy concert goer, so I want to be able to go to a concert with Kelly and for both of us to go and have a great time.
But, I mean, you know, in the vast spectrum of stuff that brings a couple together, how important is music, do you think?
Well, you know, I used to think it was very important. If my taste didn't align with somebody that I was on a date with, it was like the nail in the coffin. As I've gotten older, I've started to realize that there's other things that are much more important. But this is important, too, because when we're in the house and we turn the stereo on, I want to be able to listen to something that we both enjoy. You know, when we're in the car and we're spending the day together running errands or whatever, it's the same thing.
Yeah, but I'm hearing that, Kelly, it's just less important to you. It's not like you're, like, actively knee-jerk yelling at him when he plays something you don't like.
No,
right?
No, it's not that at all. It's just I just don't know. I'm purely just naive to the world of music around me. The last time, I mean, I went to Lollapalooza this year, and it was all these bands I'd never, ever heard of.
Yeah, and that's not actually good music.
At Lollapalooza?
Not all of it.
Not all of it, but I mean...
We're going to start another argument here. Another
a thin proportion of the 130. Yeah.
See, Jim and I are like a couple that argue all the time,
yeah.
too, so we totally empathize with what you're going through right now, Andrew and Kelly. So, Kelly, let's back it up here a little bit, getting a little sense of where you're coming from. If you had to, say, pick kinds of music or bands or songs that sort of define what you consider to be good music, can you give us a little sense of that?
I'd say Queen is my first and foremost, and always will be. Mika, the British pop singer from England.
Mm-hmm.
Don't look at me like that. I would say that I just like music that's fun and that I have a good time to. I don't get into moods and want to listen to sad, somber music on rainy days like
right.
certain people that I'm dating. I like to listen to fun music that makes me want to like dance down the street.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. But you love these certain kinds of 70s and 80s bands, and some of the ones that I'm seeing here on your forum, Boston, Journey, Bon Jovi, what is it about that?
Oh, man, it makes me sound so sad saying it.
Yeah?
No, it's the music. I listen to music. I don't necessarily listen to words. There's a very few artists that I actually listen to words with.
And you are not ashamed to be singing a Journey song at the top of your lungs in a crowded bar with 500 other people.
That would be my grad school experience.
Okay. And Andrew, if you can sort of specify, you know, same thing, four or five areas of music or artists or songs that sort of define what you consider to be good music.
Sure. Well, like I said, I'm constantly in the search for the next great thing. But I'll always hold on to certain bands, like the Beatles, Bob Dylan, Wilco. I love lyrical singer-songwriters that can also construct beautiful melodies.
All right, so what I'm hearing is that you want a little bit of intelligence and a little bit of depth into whatever it is you're hearing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also great production.
What is it about Kelly's music that you don't like? I mean, I understand not liking Journey, but Queen, I don't know. Cotton Eye or Queen?
Oh, no, I like Queen.
Okay.
It's one of the rare crossovers on our list.
Okay. I think we've got it. So what we're going to try to do here, just to explain, is that we are each going to try to give you some music that you both can enjoy, sort of bringing together your tastes and finding some common ground. And this is coming from a man who married a woman with a huge Barbra Streisand fixation. So I'm just telling you, it can be done. We've overcome that. You can overcome Styx, Kelly and Andrew. You can do it. And what I'm going to suggest is a band that I think references some of those 70s and 80s bar bands that Kelly so dearly loves and that Andrew so quickly dismisses, and yet brings some huge elements that Andrew loves, in particular the love of the Beatles, the love of some perhaps surprising depth in what's going on in the lyrics. I'm going to recommend the latest Cheap Trick record, and it is called The Latest. A band with a pedigree that goes back to the 70s and 80s. You've probably heard The Flame on about a million jukeboxes around the world. I would agree. That's kind of a lame song. I wouldn't want to hear that song again.
Cheap Trick now says it's a lame song.
Yeah, and they certainly had their period where they were kind of playing the radio game. They're back to sort of being a self-contained unit now. A lot of all the songwriting is coming from within the band, Rick Nielsen in particular. But what I love about this band is that Robin Zander is kind of like all three Beatles vocalists rolled into one, McCartney, Lennon, and George Harrison. And Kelly, you're talking about upbeat, up-tempo, wanting that energy. Well, Bunny Carlos is just the greatest drummer in the world. I mean, if you can't rock out and pump your fist to a Bunny Carlos, then I feel sorry for you, because I think there's no doubt that he will get you to that place that you want to get. And Andrew, I think this band has the combination of these ornate arrangements and melodies and the violence in some of the guitar playing that speaks to a deeper band. And also, Rick Nielsen, I think, is a very clever and underrated lyricist. So I want you to give this record a chance. I think
like
it's something that you can both agree on.
You know why I like it? Because I think you found something for Kelly, but you're also challenging Andrew. Because I can just hear him saying, Cheap Trick?
Yeah, come on.
You should see the look on his face right now.
I come to you two hipsters, you know, on the cutting edge of medicine, and you give me Cheap Trick?
Yeah. I'm very surprised, actually, Greg, but I'm totally open.
People are surprised all the time when I mention Cheap Trick, and I will go to the wall and say that their first four or five studio albums are among the finest albums I own. And people look at me, you got to be crazy. And I said, listen to those records. There is an amazing amount of depth beneath that surface there. And I think that's what I'm hoping, Andrew, that you, with your ears, your well-trained ears, will find when you listen to this record.
Dr. Codd, that's a good one, and I second it. I was stumped. I was trying to find something where it was completely, maybe you'd both have to stretch. The thing that really struck me, Kelly, was when you said, you know, dancing down the street and music to have a good time to. So I'm thinking about bars and 80s, and I'm thinking about, like, 80s pop, and I'm thinking, like, Yaz and Depeche Mode and Eurythmics, and you may just think I'm crazy here, but I have been fixated for the last couple of weeks on this album, a debut album from the UK by LaRue. They are a two-person band, much like Yaz used to be, with a young woman who is very, very striking. Looks like Tilda Swinton dressed up as David Bowie. LaRue is French for the red-haired one, except it's male, so there's a little bit of gender bending going on the part of the front woman, Eleanor Ellie Jackson. She's the singer. Her partner is Ben Langmaid, who plays all the instruments. Together, they make this wonderful dance pop, but it's really smart dance pop. Basically, neither of you had anything like this in your medical files, and that's why I want to give you a complete curveball and see what you do with it.
Great.
So LaRue and Cheap Trick, I don't think they expected anything like this.
I know. I could tell by the shocked silence.
Yeah. So will you go home and take your medicine for a week and then check back with us?
Absolutely.
Yes, we will.
I'm looking forward to it.
And no fighting, okay? No fighting about this. You can have a spirited, enthusiastic discussion, but I don't, you know.
You'll find out next week if only one of us is talking to you.
Oh, okay. That'll be the good sign.
All right, well, we'll put it to the test.
You better call me.
All right, let's welcome Kelly and Andrew back to the show. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you so much.
It is a week later, and we trust that you've been taking your prescriptions, so we want to check back and see if they work. Dr. Cott, you want to start with yours?
Well, I'm a little nervous, I have to say. You know, I was kind of wondering, you know, I prescribed Cheap Trick's The Latest as a potential record that both of you might enjoy. So, Kelly, why don't you tell me what your reaction to it was first?
Well, what's so funny is that immediately after we got off the phone with you guys last week, we pulled up a couple of the other Cheap Trick stuff from their earlier days.
Yeah.
Kind of rocked out to that in a really cheesy way. but I understand why you did it, but, you know, I don't really listen much to lyrics, but I could not help notice how bad I thought the lyrics were for the latest album.
Really?
I really thought that they were just, like, cliched. Like, I'd heard them all before by bands who had done it much better. I can't decide where the story begins or it dies. I'm the way back from your heart to mine while time passes by. And, like, the music was there. If I were, you know, at a bar and they were a bar band, I would be very happy hanging out listening to them. But for me, it really just gave me this idea of 40-year-old women in the front row with their beer acting like they're still 20.
Yeah.
Like, that's the vibe I got from it. So, like, I, you know, their music was fun, and it wasn't, like, the most horrible thing I've ever heard, but I wasn't thrilled with it.
Well, I'm dreading now to think what Andrew's going to say about it since Kelly didn't like it. I thought I had a chance with Kelly, but Andrew, okay, let me have it.
Okay. Well, I'd like to take the rock doctor analogy a little further, if I may.
Yeah.
This prescription was a little like getting the flu vaccine. You get the shot for the flu, and you wind up sick with the flu for like 3 days.
So right? You won't get the flu, yeah.
And then eventually you get over it.
Right.
So, you know, the first couple of spins on the record was a bit painful, and I kept having to remind myself to just listen to it and put aside my preconceived notions about the band.
Right.
And what I found out was that it's not an awful album. It's actually quite energetic. Like you guys said, the drumming is fantastic. And I give props to these guys for putting out a heavy power rock album at their age, you know? I really, really do. And I do respect their place in musical history.
Right.
I also don't want to listen to them, yeah. A bit cheesy and overblown.
Yeah.
But, you know, I found some elements of George Harrison and that song Closer, the Ballad of Bert and Linda. Singing about relax your mind and the heaven's gonna rain or shine. There's definitely some echoes there of some of Harrison's solo efforts, I find.
And we totally get why you prescribed it to us when we listened to it. We understood it completely.
Right.
If anything, I'd say that you brought us together in a band that we weren't thrilled with.
You know, I'm thinking about it and I go, that's kind of a triumph in its own way, in a perverse way. Unintentional, but nonetheless.
I think, Dr. Cott, you had a patient walk in to your office with a steak knife in their eye, and you told them, you really got to lose some weight. It's just like, you know, what?
Hey, you know, I've been batting 1,000 so far. I'm going to get one wrong once in a while. You know?
It's true. I've gone down in flames and been sued for malpractice more often. So let's shift over to LaRue. I suggested this wonderful English, I think they're wonderful, dance pop duo. Kelly, why don't you start?
I loved it. I had a really good time, like just kind of dancing around to it in my house by myself. And mm-hmm. I just enjoyed it. I had a really good time listening to it.
I like that. All right. Andrew?
Well, this is a great album. There's just Yay. No doubt about that. And it actually speaks to a whole different side of my musical personality that we didn't talk about last week. And that's, you know, I have a love for great electronic music.
Emerging from my world, imagine living in a box, and I won't come up until I've broken all the locks. Slurring all my words until something sticks, but in this smoky universe, my mind keeps playing tricks.
And I think that this group is following in the footsteps of the great Bjork, but also, you know, keeping up with contemporaries like St. Vincent and Florence and the Machine.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really exciting album. I think that this is a duo that is making a statement, you know, that they're artists and they have something to share with us.
And I figured that if Kelly really liked it, then that's like, okay, yeah, I like it too.
Yeah. You know, it was funny. We put that first track on, and both of us, we sort of lit up, you know? We looked at each other and we were like, okay. And the album just keeps going from there. We both really enjoyed it a lot.
I gotta say, Dr. DeRogatis, this experimental treatment, I was dubious about it, but clearly, it worked.
Excellent.
So, Kelly and Andrew, I'm sad to say that I won't be seeing you at the next Cheap Trick show, but we're very, very happy that Dr. D here found something that you both can agree on and feel confident that the relationship can now flourish the way it was always meant to be.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. We can't wait to catch LaRue in concert next time they come back in town.
And happy Valentine's Day, Kelly and Andrew.
Thank you
so much. You too. You guys, you know, you guys share the love with each other.
We always do.
Bye. Right,
bye-bye.
I loved a girl once beyond compare. She saw inside me and gave me air. She was assisting my surgery. My heart was open as she put a mask on me. I'm breathing, but it's become a chore. Now that you've seen the doctor, don't call me anymore.
To nominate someone for a visit to the Rock Doctors, fill out a new patient form at soundopinions.org. To make a comment on the air, leave a message on our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with a review of the first record from Sade in almost a decade.
I swallowed whole. My heart starts beating. DiCaprio. Different to ignore. Now that you've seen the doctor, don't call me. I underwent, and it smelled of a wild goose chase. Then I saw your face upside down. He comes in creeping, he is a creep. A samurai, it's no fair peeking. That is a lie. Mermaid on Pico, lifts her fin, demands a towel. Then thinking of you,
of my heart. But I'm still alive. Still looking for the light. In the endless pool on the other side. It's a wild, wild west. I'm doing my best.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That is Sade with the title track of her new album, Soldier of Love. Greg, I think a lot of people think Sade, and it is pronounced Sade, although it's spelled S-A-D-E, and they think the Reagan-Thatcher years. You know, it's like, wow, time warp. And she was the queen of Quiet Storm R&B from the mid-80s through the early 90s. Born in Nigeria, raised in Britain, Helen Folasade Adu has been missing from the pop world for nearly a decade. Her fifth album, Lover's Rock, came out in November 2000. People have been like, where is Sade? And I should note, like PJ Harvey, Sade is the name of the band as well as the name of the singer. Mm-hmm. She's been doing a lot of living during that downtime. She was married in Spain. That ended. She was in a relationship in Jamaica. That fell apart. She had a child. And now she is living in the English countryside with a true love, apparently a former Royal Marine, raising her daughter and returning to music with the key players who made all of those hits with her in the 80s and 90s. She really defined that era with songs like Smooth Operator and Hang On to Your Love and The Sweetest mm-hmm. Taboo. It was a very mellow, sultry, seductive sound. This was make-out music made with real instruments, minimally arranged, and that sultry voice of hers. A lot of people, you know, always said, well, this is a conservative artist. You know, it kind of epitomizes those then new CD players that people were drinking cappuccino or sipping Chardonnay and listening to Sade. But there's a lot of soul in this woman. You know, it was always her approach to romance was a very personal one. And if you really took the time to listen, this was a distinctive artist. Now, Sony Epic, her record label, is very excited about this record. A mega push, unlike anything we've seen since Susan Boyle. They think there's this new market out there of older listeners who want mature music. We're going to give our thoughts about Sade, but let's play a track from Soldier of Love. This is called Moon and Sky on Sound Opinions.
I was the one, I who could pull in all the stars above, lay them on your feet, and I gave you my love. You are the one that got me started.
That is The Moon and the Sky on Sound Opinions from Sade, only the sixth studio album she has released since 1984. She takes her time about everything, you know, whether it's releasing albums or singing a song. Nothing seems to hurry this woman, and it is a sound all its own. You listen to this record from a distance, Jim, and you think, you know, it's the girl from Ipanema walking down the beach, and it's kind of mellow, and it's pretty. But you probe a little deeper, you get a little closer to the music, and you realize that there's a lot of melancholy and a lot of turmoil bubbling through this music. She's a woman who's lived a very full life. It's not just all about music for Sade, and she brings what she has lived into her music. These regrets, the heartbreak, the loneliness, occasionally the despair that creeps into this music and gives it some resonance.
You are the blood of me, the harvest of my dreams. There's nowhere I can find peace, and the silence won't cease. Nothing's quiet as it seems.
Her band has been the exact same, as you said. These three guys that she's been working with since the 80s, they have their own sound. You know, you're going to get that swoony saxophone, and you're going to get those very sparse keyboards, and then you're going to get that kind of subterranean misty bass lines that running through it. You know, it's not wholly aggressive. That's why the title track, Soldier of Love, is kind of a departure for her. That's kind of the biggest beat she's ever put on any song ever. But, you know, the rest of the album is going to sound very familiar to people who have been fans of this artist since the mid-80s, you know. It's not about changing up or reinvention for her. It's about, this is me, this is my sound, this is what I do best. I can't say that there are any big dark secrets revealed here. We know exactly what this record is going to sound like in a way. But the fact that she took 10 years off and that this record is being put out now, it's kind of a welcome return. I don't see it as a blockbuster in any sense. I'm going to give it a buy it, though, because it is so well done. And the way she sort of works into these genres like reggae and even country music without making it sound like she's compromising anything. Sade is who she is, and she's straddled these different eras of soul music very well. I think she's one of the, you know, the timeless artists of our time.
Well, I will second your buy it, Greg. I think that if she was making this record every 18 months, we'd have been sick of it by now, but she has been gone long enough and has changed just enough. Her voice at age 51 is a little deeper and more resonant, and you know, there are some dark moments here.
Yeah.
You know, there's a theme that runs through the entire record, as might be indicated by the title. You know, love is a battlefield.
Yeah.
Soldier of love, okay? And she's fought the wars over the last 10 years and emerged to tell about it, much like Mary J. Blige.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not nearly as fiery an artist, but this is a fine record. I double your buy it. What do we have on the show next week?
Jim, we might as well bring Sade back because she'd fit in perfectly with next week's show. We're going to give you some musical choices to set the mood for Valentine's Day.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. Sound Opinions was produced by our team of Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn, monopolistic themselves, but lovable. And our executive producer and fearless leader is Tori Southside Malatia, a man who was so excited about the return of Sade, he took the whole week off to be with this new album. On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. Now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
I'm Drew from Memphis, Tennessee. I just wanted to thank you for mentioning the passing of Jay Retard in your news segment. I discovered Jay a couple of years ago during his Matador singles period, and of course I heard about him around town. His album Blood Visions and his Matador singles record are terrific, but his latest album, Watch Me Fall, is amazing.
It ain't gonna save me.
Thank you.
showcases his proficiency and skill as a musician and a songwriter. We've had a number of terrific bands record albums here in Memphis, Sonic Youth, Pavement, Wilco. I think they've all recorded here at some point. But Jay was really single-handedly putting Memphis on the map in terms of the indie scene with his work with Matador Records. And the work he was doing was really exciting. So I know he'll be dearly missed by his Memphis fans and all fans of good rock and roll everywhere. Thanks.
Hi, this is Charles calling from Illinois. I just wanted to thank you guys for having Charles Thompson from the Pixies on. The thing I found most interesting about the interview was he had mentioned that the Pixies were trying to sound like a band that they had listened to, and you brought up the example of Nirvana trying to sound like the Pixies. I'd heard a quote from John Lennon one time that the Beatles, when they started out, were trying to sound like Elvis.
Right down and cry over you. I'm gonna sit right down and cry over you. And if you ever say goodbye, and if you ever even try, I'm gonna sit right down and cry over you.
It's like the bands that are copying a sound and get it right end up being mediocre, right? But the bands that try to copy a sound, but they're so unique that they can't help it, they come out really different, are the ones that often turn out brilliant. I just think it's cool. Thanks.
Hey guys, this is Joe from Westchester. Love the show. Listen to the podcast every week. Just listened to this week's and heard Greg's Desert Island Disc. Never thought I'd hear 1,000 homo DJs on the radio unless I was playing it through my stereo. And I just wanted to suggest maybe do an album dissection of Ministry or Revco or any of Jorgensen's stuff, or even get the man himself in the studio. Definitely underappreciated label and scene. So definitely a ton of influence, but hasn't always gotten it to do. Thanks. Love the show.
More messages.
To give us your opinion on sound opinions, call our hotline 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with sound opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.